Education Committee to order, please. Thank you for being here. Today is Thursday, February 27th, 2020. The time is 9 a.m. In attendance are Senator Coghill, Senator Begich, and myself, Stevens. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're going to be hearing Senate Bill 136 relating to state tribal education compacts. Intention today is to continue the conversation on the concept of the bill and to hear from the advocates and any stakeholders talking about the potential benefits, challenges of tribal compacting, and, of course, hold the bill for further review. Any questions or comments before we start, gentlemen? Thank you. We have Senator Hughes with us as well. So we'll begin with invited testimony. Joel Isaac is in the room with us. If you please come forward, state your name and your affiliation. Joel, good to see you here.
Jukili Tagashnesh, Dene Ina Sakayesh Shiiji, Gashtana Joel Isaac Shiiji, through the chair. My name is Shlek Ayis and Denina, and my English name is Joel Isaac for the record. Jangu Akwan Esnanak Nu Chko Chdesh, Shichida Fedora Calendar Pennington, Begu Bakaya Point Possession Vailatan Anchorage Rodu Denina Eshlanjit. Today we are living and working on the land of the Akwan. My grandmother is from Point Possession and Anchorage, and I am Dena'ina Athabaskan. I serve as the tribal liaison for the Department of Education and Early Development, and I am an educator who is a product of the K-12 and university system here in Alaska. In Alaska, we have very hardworking, highly qualified, dedicated educators and brilliant students working to fulfill state education policy section 14.03.015. And I'm going to read that just to kind of couch the conversation for why are we talking about compacting. It is the policy of a state that the purpose of education is to help ensure that all students will succeed in their education and work, shape worthwhile and satisfying lives for themselves, exemplifying the best values of society, and be effective in improving the character and quality of the world about them. Our education system faces many obstacles and challenges to make that policy come to fruition. The issues we face are not new. I remember in grade school here in Alaska, those around me attending funerals of classmates who were in high school and grade school who had committed suicide. I remember standing in a doorway when I was 12 years old and preventing a situation from escalating, and the person ended up not taking their life. I remember wondering when I would go to sleep if I would see people in the morning. And those are pretty substantial challenges, and we still face those today. My childhood experiences are not unique to just me. And it raises the question, since the leading cause of death for teenagers in our state is suicide, how can our education system continue to do great work to meet that policy to help ensure that all students shape worthwhile and satisfying lives? It's a really big goal, and it's important that we take the time to think about those things. To help address the wide range of challenges that impact our educational system here in Alaska, starting in September of 2016, the State Board of Education and Early Development established 5 strategic priorities aimed at improving public education for all students in Alaska. Number 1 was to amplify student learning, 2, ensure excellent educators, 3, modernized education system, 4, inspire tribal and community ownership of educational excellence, number 5, promote safety and well-being. A 20-member tribal and community ownership committee was established as part of the Alaska Education Challenge, which I'm sure you all have heard about before. The committee was formed to specifically address strategic priority number 4, inspiring tribal and community ownership of educational excellence. The recommendation was put forward to create the option for self-governance compacting for the delivery of education between the state of Alaska and tribes or tribally empowered Alaska Native organizations. The committee defined what a compact would be, and and what that meant. And the definition was self-governance compacting for the delivery of education to mean that tribes or tribally empowered Alaska Native organizations exercise their rights in partnership with the state of Alaska to assume the responsibilities and associated funding to carry out programs, functions, services, and activities that the state of Alaska would otherwise be obligated to provide. The State Board of Education Early Development accepted the recommendation as part of the Alaska Education Challenge. Simply put, compacting can be defined as a government-to-government agreement that provides a framework to address the needs of a specific arena, in this case, education. A compact outlines the terms of an agreement, the accountability measures, and the funding agreement. Those are basic tenets of what a compact would entail. Compacts have a very long-standing proven track record as a method for providing local control while still having accountability, and they provide a flexible platform to address the education needs here in Alaska. Compacting is simply another option for students, parents, and communities to have for choosing how their students would participate in education. All Alaskans, all students, and their communities stand to benefit from having access to additional pathways for learning. State tribal compact schools, in accordance with Alaska State Constitution, would be public schools open to all students. Tribes would have the freedom to choose to enter into the compacts. I'm going to pause for questions. If there's any questions, I just give a lot of definitions and things.
Well, thank you, Joel. I appreciate your last comment about open to all students. We've received an attorney's opinion about preferential, both hiring, preferentially hiring Native teachers and preferentially allowing students, only Native students first, and then others later. Do you have any comments on that? Because, frankly, the attorney's opinion is an attorney's opinion. It's always very long and very involved and many pages, four pages, I think. And really what it winds up saying, it's going to wind up in court. But could you give us your perspective on the idea of first prioritizing hiring of teachers, which just makes a lot of sense to me if we're doing tribal compact, but then also, which might be more problematic, because I think in my villages on my island in Kodiak, they're quite mixed with Native kids and Caucasian kids and African-American kids and all sorts of kids, you know. So that would be one of my main concerns, is how we make sure that all children in a village would be able to attend that tribal school and would not be prejudicially left out. Any thoughts on that?
Through the chair, those are questions that often come up when talking about this. And I think there's two examples that show the approach that we've been using within the department for thinking about the complex matters for compacting. One is there's called TARO. It's a tribal employment ordinance process that already meets law. It's legal to do that. And so using those current frameworks that already exist, we're not having to create a new pathway. This is a proven, legally sound method for hiring. And mm-hmm. Tribes currently use this practice for hiring. So it would make sense to maybe look at that as a template or an example, or just simply state that we're going to be following TARO.
And tell me the name, it's tribal?
Tribal employment, and then I can't remember the R, and then ordinance. Sorry, it's one of those things that's always acronyms. Then it's like, oh, wait, what does that actually? So that's a federally observed thing, and tribes are currently using it in the state for hiring practices. And then, again, looking at models that already exist for preference for enrollment for students, if we look at what Head Start uses currently as a model for enrolling students, that might be a very good place to start, because that program has already worked through how to do that and address that concept. So it wouldn't be something new, but perhaps looking at if that enrollment preference would be a good fit as well for the K-12. So those would be the two ways and the approaches that we've been using within the department to look at.
Thank you, Joel. I appreciate it. Any questions from Senator Hughes?
The tribal employment and whatever the R is might be recruitment ordinance. How does it give points, more points if someone has a cultural connection? Is that how it works? Just so we understand. You said it's proven, it's stood up in court, but just so we understand it. And then the Head Start model for enrollment, it goes back to the chair's original point, is Head Start cannot accept all the children, so they prioritize. And we could end up still with children if that method is used in a community where they would not have the option to go to the public school. So I'm kind of concerned about that model because it does leave some students out.
Through the chair, there is a point system that goes through that, and all speaking to Tarot, and then also generally the process of job posting, it's heavily involved through like a Tarot committee that takes the lens of how does this align with the tribe's vision, values, stance. So it's kind of a two-part piece where making sure that the job posting itself and the requirements is meeting and aligning, and then how you evaluate the scoring of that. And then to speak to the Head Start preference concept, tribes have shown a lot of evidence that they are not trying to exclude students. There are, from the Head Starts that I've talked to, the tribes are working at additional funding to open up more classroom space for the students that don't qualify. And they're abiding by Head Start federal statutes for the way that they operate, but they're providing their own funding to make more space for students. And so I think that's an example of tribes are committed to all students in their communities, on the road system and off the road system. That's happening in both locations. And 14 of the Head Starts in the state, out of their 17 Head Starts operating in the state, 14 of them are tribally operated. And so there is a body of evidence showing that there is a desire to serve all students. So that's looking, and like I said, looking for an example of what might be a way to do that, but not providing, like, here's the answer today.
And we have questions also from Senator Coghill and Senator Begich. If you could, on the same subject, Senator Hughes?
Yes, sir. My hope is that we would just take out the prioritization of the students and just require that the school take all the students in the community that are interested in attending. And I was just wondering if you think that is a workable model or it is not workable.
I think that a school, if we think about a community that has one school in it, or even two, the school and would be taking all students, and you make it work. That's what educators do, and that's what the tribes have been doing as well. If you look at like the healthcare model for accepting all patients, that concept, and the tribes leading the charge to see anyone who would come to the clinic. So I think that that the goal would be to serve all students. And it's a question, and that's part of the having this discussion with the tribes, for them to be able to speak for themselves on it, but also that's the intention, is to be open to all students.
Very yes, small, please. Because this was brought up the first meeting, the clinics being used as an example, and that was a world I came from before in the legislature. The tribal clinics are receiving federally qualified health center funds, which require them to see all patients. So the goodness of the hearts of the people might be that they'd open the doors even if they didn't receive that funding, but under law they are required. So my concern again is if we have some prioritization, if we're going to open the door and include all the students in a community that only has one school, why don't we just have it so that the tribally compacted school will accept, you know, all students in the community that are interested, and that would be my preference. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator Hughes. A very good point, and that's going to be a big discussion, I think, among us, and we're anxious to hear from the tribal entities and see what they think. But when I think about my communities, like a village of Old Harbor with 200 people and maybe 50 kids, there's one school already there, and it might be turned over to the tribal entity. And you wouldn't want to have, a tribal school and a public school, a separate public school. So, and as you say, the people would, I think, willingly accept all kids in that situation. Senator Coghlan, then Senator Begich.
I just wanted to go back to part of your testimony, which I thought was very, very well done. In describing the government-to-government relationship, you outlined three basic tenets. Bring those out again. I want to write them down. I want to ponder how we might approach each one of those tenets. I thought that was very well said. So if you wouldn't mind rehearsing that to us.
Yeah. Yes. Through the chair, there are the three components that make up a successful compact, and one is it's the kind of the master agreement. It's the terms of the agreement. There are the accountability measures, and there's the fiscal agreement. Those are three like major concepts that need to be addressed when thinking about compacting. And that's part of the success of the compacting process, is it allows for that discussion to be had before an agreement is signed. So that's one of the foundations of it.
Mr. Chairman, I thought that was very well said, and that gives us really strong footholds to think about how we move forward. The other question then is what I perceive as a fluid relationship that has a hard time figuring out what that government is, right? So we have 227, I think, tribal entities, but then we also expand that to say tribal affected groups or something like that. So that's a pretty broad range, and each one might be just a little different, if I understand correctly. So can you give us, based on these three tenets you brought up, is there a normal tenet and then a room for those flex points that we need to think about as we go into agreeing on tribal compacting? What does that look like, and where are the flex points?
Through the chair, yes. There are 229 federally recognized tribes in the state. The language that says, or a tribally empowered organization is the term that's used there. The reason why that kind of language is included is that currently a lot of the federal programs allow for that as well. When we talk about tribally empowered organizations in the compacting discussion, a tribe would pass a resolution as a governing body that says this tribally empowered organization is representing us on our behalf. So that empowered organization just doesn't automatically come to the table and start negotiating, or they have to have that direction from their tribe. There are a very wide range of organizations like these. Tanana Chiefs Conference is an example of one, where it's an organization that's comprised of many tribes that have said through resolution that the Tanana Chiefs will do these things on our behalf. If we look at the Indian Health Service compacting model, that is one of the things of it, is that there might be a compactor who's signing who represents a group of tribes, or as part of the terms of the compact, they are agreeing to provide services for an area that encompasses these tribes. So that's part of the process of how the compacts are negotiated, and that negotiation process allows for tribes to identify that they would like to participate in it. And what we've been talking about with the compacting is that it's an option. So it's something that tribes would be stating, we have the intentions or the desire to enter into a negotiation process.
Well, thank you, Joe.
That's the start of the questioning, but that's a good framework, and so that's what I was looking for. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Exactly. Thank you. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Tribal Employment Rights Ordinance, a number of kibitzers made sure I knew that. Talking, so that they are as rights. But you'd mentioned that you still saw that under compacting, in your view, that compacted schools would still be public schools under the Alaska Constitution. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that. So I guess the first question I have is how do you see the jurisdiction of the department then your department employee, vis-a-vis a tribal compacted school? Would a couple of questions related to that. Would, we use standardized measurement and tests. How do you see those being part of the process and Would these students be outside of that process? Would they be within that process? How do you see departmental authority? In the bill, we talk about employees of the state, but I'm not sure what, you know, what the vision is that's out there right now. And then third, in jurisdictions that already have jurisdiction, I know we're going to hear from the Yanni Daw School. And, Mr. Chairman, I should mention my brother Nick was tribal administrator in Chicoloon during the time when they secured some of the grants that started the Yanni Daw School. But that's within the Mat-Su Borough School District. So how are you seeing those kinds of relationships? And then, well, I'll just leave it at that. That's a lot of questioning I just gave you. But if we start there, then I might have one other question after that.
Through the chair, those are all questions that frequently come up. And if I may just speak broadly to thinking about that organizational flow, if you will. And so we have the state constitution that gives the premise for education. And then we have that the legislature is the body that has the authority. The legislature passes that authority and authorizes the State Board of Education and the commissioner to execute education as an administrator. And that level of government, if we're thinking about compacting, what has come up is that the tribal governments would negotiate and sign with the commissioner the funding, and all the state statutes and the constitutional mandates that are there would still apply to these schools as public schools, but the compact would allow for the flexibility and innovation that's needed to do education from an indigenous lens. In order to still receive the state funding and the federal funding, the same tests would be applied, the same evaluation measures. So it's not trying to create a separate system. It allows for flexibility within the current structure to really do that localized control, and it's following the same kinds of statutes that already exist. So that's kind of the big organizational flow of how that might work. There were a lot of questions that you asked. If you don't mind repeating anything that I didn't catch in that.
Yeah, let's try to cut them up a little bit in pieces.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, I think he's actually captured most of them in that view, and it triggered the thought on what my other question was, so a tribal compacting doesn't necessarily mean immersion. Sometimes we tend to equate the two. In fact, it's really locally developed, locally identified kinds of curriculum that would be evolved with from the local community with a sign off essentially from the department. Is that a fair appraisal?
I would say that what the compacting allows to happen is that the tribes get to choose the medium, sure, of education. So if we think about that, could be the language of instruction. It could be what constitutes a classroom. Is your classroom being outside a lot of the time? Those kinds of things that statute already allows for, but the tribes would get to make those decisions for themselves, and it's not the state or a local school board telling the tribes you have to do it this way. It's the tribes being in that self-determined way making that choice. And if I may, I have some bringing in the voices from the students. What our students wanting to see in education might also address this point, if I may.
I think so, unless there's other questions. You're okay.
I
Senator Hughes, yes.
It piggybacks on what Senator Begich just brought up, because it sounds like the tribal compacted schools would be following the statutes, but they might need more flexibility maybe in regard to the regulations and how things are carried out. So I'm just wondering, if you started to analyze the regulations, where some of those might need to be adjusted to allow that. So that first question is regarding regulation, and then do you want me to keep the second one separate, or?
No, go ahead. We're piling them on, so as you can handle it.
I just want to say I love the concept of ownership and engagement in the local community, and the buy-in and what that could mean, you know, for the students, and improved outcomes. The thing I'm concerned about is we already have 52 school districts right now. And now if we start having these separate tribal compact entities, we're going to have more administrations. And we according to national studies, and we could argue how accurate they are, but, you know, the one was by the U.S. Census Bureau that shows that we put more dollars into administration and in classrooms by a little bit more than other states. And now we're going to be creating additional administrations. So my question is there a conversation or would you be open to considering a requirement or at minimum an incentive for shared administration? So we're not, right now we have 52 superintendents and 52 CFOs and 52, you know, curriculum directors or all the different administrators. So we're not even creating more of those. Has there been any conversation about shared administrations, and would that work?
To the chair, the first question being about the regulations, we have been looking at what regulations might need to be addressed. The regulation process would still flow through the State Board of Education, again, not creating an outside entity to do that. And there's been a lot of public comment about what those things might need to be. Some of them have been curriculum, the like teacher certification process, reporting mechanisms, assessment mechanisms, all the very wide range of regulations that would need to be, that could be affected, or would the desire would be to look at them closely. But just I want to emphasize that they would still flow through the current structure of regulation, so it's not creating an outside and another form of oversight for those administrative costs. And then to the second question, that has come up, and I think what illustrates it really well and the approach that we've also been using is the Indian Health Service model through the federal compacting has been going on for decades. There are a lot of successes from it, so we've been looking and talking with, like, what are those successful things? How did this come to be? And so if we think about, there is the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, there's the Alaska Native Tribal Health Board, and they're able to handle a lot of the entire state's tribally health administrative processes. So that model can serve as an example for how to cut through the administrative costs but still provide those supports when the state shares it. So I would say that, yes, that's very doable. And looking within the current statutes, what's allowed, and then what might need to be either generated or maybe through regulation might be able to address some of those things.
Thank you. Sir Hughes? Sir Megich?
Thank you. Just following up on that, Joe, when you mentioned the model of ANTHC and the Tribal Health Consortium, but I just want to be clear, too, that, you know, for me, it's also ensuring that students have access to people who are trained to teach, and regardless of the methodology. And that model uses, you know, when it delivers health care, it doesn't deliver health care. It delivers health care with people who have a qualification to deliver health care. So I guess my question is, do you envision in the compacting that the educators that are educating and that are primarily responsible for educating teachers would be certified teachers?
Through the chair, the answer to that is yes, because we'd be following state statutes. And from the tribes and the students, this is the other part that I think is really powerful, is that the students are wanting certified, highly qualified teachers too. It's perceived or has been talked about as tribes are wanting to lower the bar, and when in fact the tribes are wanting the bar to be, when there's two people lifting, the bar can be raised higher. So that's the idea of the compact, is it's a partnership. It's not a one side has to do everything model. We can raise the bar higher and help our students even more. So if we were to engage with the tribes in what would be those pieces that might need to be addressed through a certification process, which is handled through regulation, that is a conversation that tribes are very eager to have. But thinking, again, with the IHS model, you want certified cardiologists. You want an OBGYN that's trained. You want NPs. So that same type of certification and insurance of quality and excellence tribes are very much interested in having that.
Mr. Chairman, I think
Senator Baggage.
My concern here is just simply to say that I don't want the state, I mean, I like the analogy of two lifting the bar. I don't want the state to walk away from their responsibility, which is frankly delegated from our responsibility to be sure that that constitutional mandate is met. And so I'm just encouraged by hearing the collaborative way that this is being described. I fear that perhaps a different commissioner, certainly not this one, but perhaps a different commissioner, Joel, might walk away from the responsibility that the state has under the Constitution, and I wouldn't want to open that door. That's all.
Thank you. For housekeeping, we have two other speakers, and I know we can spend a lot of time with Joel, and I suspect we're going to have you come back to go into some further detail. But I had stopped you at a moment for questions from members, and you were going to talk about something else.
I think what would be helpful to continue the conversation and also really serve as a good motivation, I hosted a workshop at the First Alaskans Elders and Youth in 2017, and there were about 45 participants in that workshop, and three quarters of them were students, and the other quarter were elders. And these were the questions that I asked and the responses that they gave, and I think it just really helps give that tribal perspective and what our students are wanting to see. So the first question was, what comes to mind when you think of the term or the idea of identity? The number one answer was language, and then followed by culture, traditions, land, and waters. So that's what a quarter of the state's students, about 25%, are Alaska Native students. So if we think about what is the identity linking to that, what do you want to learn in grade school? This was a group of teenagers and elders who had gone through grade school before. The number one answer was arts. The number two was language, followed by survival skills and math. What is the point of education? Why learn? Number one was the opportunity and access. Opportunity and access is why they want to learn. Number two was the relationships, followed by respect. Those are the number two things of why they want to learn. What do you not like about the education system you're currently in? Or that you were in. Number one was it's too Western, and there were a lot of different ways of articulating that, so I'm going to voice that because that's a very broad term that often gets used. So it's too much sitting, the homework at a young age, not individualized, a lack of diverse content, a lack of accepting change, and it's kind of too cookie cutter. Followed by too much murder and safety concerns. So the number two thing that the students don't like about school is safety and fear of murder. If you could, and then following, ending on a positive note, if you could design the perfect school, what would that be? And I'm going to read directly from the quote for it. I would not get rid of math, I would not get rid of reading and writing, or all standardized tests, but I would have them secondary to cultural values. The community would teach children, every child, and there would be good food. Traditional languages and English would both be taught. That's what a perfect, that was in their mind. This, because that was a quote from an elder. And then, what is your favorite thing about school? Number one was learning and learning new things. Number two was friends and relationship building to expand your mind. So I think that that's a really powerful voice for what tribes and students are envisioning when you say when we are talking about tribal compacting and what tribal ownership really looks like. Those are the things that they're wanting to see from our youth and from our elders who had a very horrific experience in public education. This is what they wanted, and they still got those things from their education. So that's kind of the inspiration or the idea of what we're talking about. The department has had over 17 meetings that we've either hosted, co-hosted, or attended in the last about 2 years. And I've distilled down there's eight major concepts that come up when we start talking state tribal education compacting. Number one comes up at every discussion is tribal sovereignty. Number two is the feasibility and funding. How does that work? There's teacher certification and teacher retention, the need for a formal tribally led body, producing better student outcomes, the duration of the compact, and then what are the next steps to make compacting happen here in Alaska. So those are, if we're still down 2 years worth of public engagement, those are the eight things that have come up the most often and would lead to a feasible result. I think that might be a good place. I can pause, and also just that could be a conclusion as well.
Thank you, Joel. And yes, Senator Begich, we're sort of facing the clock here, but go ahead.
Tribal sovereignty, feasibility and funding, teacher certification and retention, the need for a formal tribal-led body, producing better student outcomes, the duration of the compact, and what are next steps.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Joel. I really appreciate your comments, and I look forward to hearing from you again. I'm sure we'll have a chance to speak again about this issue. I really appreciate your comment about we're not talking about lowering the bar. We're talking about raising the bar, which is crucial, and I think to all of us in this room. Yes, Senator Hughes.
Just because he gave us a number of lists and he has written testimony, I was wondering if we could get that a copy of his written testimony. I can't write fast enough for some of the
right,
lists
right,
he gave
yeah.
us. Thank you.
Is that in form that you could hand over to us?
Through the chair, yes. Okay. Aaron will work to make that happen. We'll make it happen.
I appreciate that. And make sure Tim gets that, and he'll make sure we all receive that.
Chicken egg.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much, Joel. Appreciate your comments. We have a couple of other folks that will speak to us. Lisa Wade from the Chickaloon Native Village and Siri Tuttle, the director of the Alaska Native Language Center. We'll start with Lisa Wade. Lisa, can you hear me?
Good morning, Wally Jan. Lisa Wade, Zuzekaland. My name is Lisa Wade, and I am the Health, Education, and Social Services Division Director for Chickaloon Village Traditional Council. I am also a council secretary for our tribe and a tribal citizen. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, Lisa, I hear you very clearly. Thanks. Continue.
Well, thank you for having me. I have the very distinct pleasure of stewarding the Yanida'a Tribal School, and I'm so honored to be invited to talk with you because I've been listening to the questions and the things that Joel's posed, and it's everything that you're asking, really great questions, and I think we are a really great example of answering some of those questions for you. And, I'll just go back just really briefly on the history of the school and why it's here. In 1989, we had a lot of our kids that were not doing well in the public school system. I happened to be a product of one of those kids that was never doing well in the public school system, and it really was tied to my cultural identity, and I didn't actually enter into college until I was 35 because I didn't think I could, and then I went on to have a pretty successful educational career, and now I am where I'm at. But my grandmother, Catherine Wade, saw what was happening to our kids and our identity and, what we were missing. And she was working a lot with inmates up on the correctional hill who were missing those same pieces and kept ending up in that same place. She'd try and offer them a safety net, but then they would end up back up there. So she said, we have to start really young with our kids to instill in them a sense of identity, who they are, teach them about their life ways, but also offer them an education so that they can be successful when they go out into the world as well. And so we started very small with our school, and over time we've ended up where we are now. And I'll just give you a very brief description of kind of what our makeup of our school looks like. We currently have 23 students. They're a mix of our tribal citizens, other Alaska Native, Native American students, and then non-Native students. Our school is open to everyone. We encourage anyone who wants to be part of our school and learn our cultural life ways, our values, and our language to be part of our school, so it's not exclusionary in any way. We have students who have individual learning plans, so IEPs. My daughter happens to be one of those students, and she's probably one of the most severe cases. She was adopted. She has a serious developmental prognosis that requires her to have a lot of individualized and specialized services. We have one certified teacher. We also have two teachers in training, and this is something I would like to speak to that I think is really critically important to the development of tribal schools, and that, you know, we know we have a teacher shortage around the state. The model that we've chosen is to develop from within, and so we support the education of our staff in becoming teachers. I just finished a class at the University of Southeast as part of that program, and I'm working towards a degree in special education eventually. We also participate in the IHS Tribal Compact and have for many years now. It is a very successful model, and I think it is something that this could also be modeled after. We also have what we call here behavioral health aides, which I think is also a very successful way that tribes have developed their own local, locally trained tribal citizens and community members to fill those voids in the communities. And I see teachers in training as being a very similar model to that. I think we are a really great example of collaboration with the Matsubara School District. We work very closely with Matsu Central School District to ensure that we are providing that above and beyond education that we want all of our students to have. But I would say I think the most important thing about our school is, we've also developed our policies and procedures based on reviews of several different policies and procedures that we saw through the Anchorage School District, Matsubara School District, and we've added our own things into that as well. So we are adhering to, you know, what you would consider a traditional environment. But then we also offer this really rich, robust curriculum that's almost hard to describe because it is through amazing partnerships and just really community that we've been able to be as successful as we are. And without the community and the community support that we receive, the things that we're able to offer our students just wouldn't be possible. So let me give you one example of that was the very first week of school this year, one of our former teachers, a certified teacher, went out and did a successful caribou hunt. And she brought that caribou back to our school, and we have a mobile processing trailer that we've used to actually teach them the skills and the respect and how to do these things in a good way to provide food for their families. And it is part of that development of identity and life way and the things that our kids and a lot of kids in the school district are craving. We teach values. Every month there's a different value we focus on, and this is largely done through our language, and there's universal values. One is Susetnet, which is honoring our ancestors. One this month happens to be Blodadatli, which is in hard times we focus on our humor. And so there's just so many really great things. It's hard to pick one particular thing, but I wanted just to give you a small snapshot of, you know, every day we do language for at least 2 or 3 hours, and we have several different people learning our Atna language and preserving it. And it's critically important when we only have less than 7 fluent speakers and only 1 or 2 that can come help teach it for that to be prospering in a school environment. And so we are facing this all across the state where we're having a shortage of language teachers. This is an avenue to also help with that. And it's been hugely successful in terms of we're seeing major successes in the language development. In fact, I taught a class the other day where 77 of our community members through Alaska Family Services were actually learning the language with us and doing activities with us. So I'm going to stop there because I could go on and bore you to tears with all the really amazing things I see happening here, but I think you might have a couple questions, and I'm very willing to answer them for you.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Your comments are infectious, and I can see your excitement about it. Can you locate us as to where you are, where your school is? Is it on the road system? You said you had 23 children and that you work with the Matsu School District. So where exactly are you, and how would one find you?
So we are not in Chickaloon proper. We are actually between Palmer, Alaska, and Sutton. So we're 8 miles north of Palmer. We are on the road system. We are actually located on what we consider sacred territory. It's the house where my grandmother raised me. So it's very important land base to us. And, you know, one of the great things about our school is we actually do more learning outside than we almost do inside, because understanding your environment and being able to move in your environment when you're learning is just as important as, you know, the inside learning. And so much of what we're teaching through science and math can be done outside. We even teach math in our language. So we have many successes. And I forgot to mention, you know, this school is producing college graduates. We just had a nursing, one of our former students just finished her nursing degree. We had another young man finish his GIS informatics degree and is now working in that field. So we're producing scientists. We're producing the candidates that you want coming out of school. It's not that we're just teaching the soft arts and culture as people perceive it, even though I think those are foundational to creating a whole human. We're excelling in science too. And it's because of the partnership with our tribe where we're located. We have done a lot of scientific projects, so we're able to bring our youth into those projects. So our school isn't just one place. It is in our community. It's out in our community. It's learning from the best of the best in our community.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just great to hear your voice, Lisa, and knowing all the great work you've been doing there over the years. And you can easily see the school, actually, when you come up the hill. After you've left Palmer, you wind down to one of the little valley areas, and as you're coming up, just before you get to the prison there and Sutton, it'll be on your right. It'll actually be right down there, and it's expanded over the years. But Lisa, I wanted to ask you three quick questions. One is, you've received national recognition. As I recall, Harvard recognized your curriculum and your program. Isn't that right?
Yes, we've received national recognition through Harvard as being a unique school. We also recently were invited, and we're in our second round of review through the Kellogg Foundation for a national award there as well. We produced a video on the work we're doing, and they'll be probably coming up here to visit us this spring. So, yeah, it's a really unique model, and it does receive a lot of attention, sometimes almost too much, but I think it's because, you know, we're very unique in that what we're doing. And it's taken a great many years to figure this out. And I think one of the things we are doing is sharing what we're doing with other communities, because it is replicable. It's just it's taken a long time for us to break down some barriers in that collaboration with the school district to really get them to understand why kids need this. You know, I will say I get called all the time from parents. It's been a hard year because I've had to reject parents from wanting to bring their children to our school. And it's because a lot of kids, especially kids with social emotional issues that are in the foster care system, Alaska Native kids, are not doing well in the school system. And it's been really hard for me to say, you know, we're at our capacity. We just expanded our facility. We used to have one large classroom, and we were really blessed to have some really great backers that saw what we were doing and allowed us to expand and to have a whole nother classroom. So we were able to expand from 12 students last year to 23 this year. And, you know, I take a very cautious approach. I don't want to grow beyond what we can manage. And, you know, I think that's part of sound leadership. We rely on our parent committee to help guide, you know, if they see something they would like us to be focusing on or something they don't see that is a benefit to us, then we really rely on a lot of people to help guide what we're doing here.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Begich.
Just a couple other very quick questions. Is it possible, and I'll combine them, is it possible for you to send us a copy of your policy and procedures that you mentioned? You said you'd worked and looked at other policies and developed one, and I think that could be very informative to the committee. And also, is it possible, it sounds like you may not have a sort of a formalized curriculum, but if you do, is it possible to get a copy of that as well?
We do use formalized curriculums. I would say I will tell you exactly what it is. It is, I work with a teacher advisor through Mat-Su Central School District. It's not one standard curriculum. That's why I'm kind of describing it as opposed to providing it. But we utilize a method of teaching textbooks for our math, which is an online program. And the reason we do that is that, one, it allows the students to have some individualized work on their own. When we have one teacher in the classroom providing lessons for numerous grade levels, you can't teach to one specific group at a time. You have to kind of focus your attention and move throughout. So it allows us to kind of track who's struggling with specific topics and then provide that individualized instruction that they need. We have many tutors that work with our students. So if we see someone who's not doing well with that curriculum and that teaching textbooks, we also bring in our volunteers to come help tutor, and one of those would be our peace officer, who happens to be amazing with math. It takes an entire village, really, to help educate, too. So we rely on that. We use Time for Learning for our high school students for language arts. And then a lot of our other curriculum is given to us directly from the school district. For instance, right now for our high school students, I'm teaching civics based on curriculum provided through Mat-Su Central. I'm teaching U.S. history, provided curriculum to them. But we also offer other viewpoints as well. So we have, our tribal leadership, the history of tribal leadership in Alaska. We offer things like that through written documents that we've received. There was just a national publication that came out in anthropology about tribal leadership, and we provide things like that. So it's not off-the-cuff kind of leadership. It's the Alaska Journal of Anthropology. So our students are studying that as well. So we do use a mixed curriculum, but it is all vetted for the most part for the primary subject matter. And then we follow the credit hours and the requirements to graduate that have been established by the state and the school district.
And Lisa, but and that's great description, by the way. Of course, you would have a varied curriculum because of the varied population.
And ages. We have pre-K various ages. All the way through high school.
But a copy of the policy and procedures, is that something we could take
sure.
a look at? That'd be great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Baggett. So, Lisa, a pleasure to hear what you're doing, a very successful school. You've done that. How would this bill before us have any impact on you, tribal compacting? Would it change things at all? Are you at all interested in seeing this bill go forward?
I'm absolutely hopeful for this bill. Our tribe, sometimes we're seen as folks that rock the boat or whatever, but at the most fundamental core of everything is we want collaboration. We strive for collaboration. But we also want recognition, and that's the hard part, and that's the barrier that's been there. When Joel brought up tribal sovereignty, we've done projects with the state that have had significant barriers, and they're silly. They're things that if they were out of the way, we could do so much more. And I think the state's in this place where they can't do this all over the entire state. But tribes are really poised to be great partners. They might need help with infrastructure development or development in terms of, licensure of their teachers, but they need pathways. And I think we've done this on so many other things, the behavioral health aid, the dental health aid. We've had some great successes in that. I'm working towards chemical dependency counselor certification expansion, all these different areas where we know that we have partners that can help us develop this through the healthcare system. We also know that we have partners through the school districts that could be helping us with this. It doesn't take, I heard one of the questions was how much more of a burden would this place upon creating new administrations and things like that. And I would say it helps in some regard because, you know, we take on a lot of that leadership structure, and I see that is a strong thing. It's not saying we want to be the most important player in developing this. It's saying we want to partner, and we just don't want those barriers to be in the way for us to be able to do this. And that's really over the past 5 years where I think we've had tremendous success out here in the Valley with the school district. And it took a lot of relationship building. You know, we used to not have any support in terms of curriculum. We are a privately funded school. We have no funding from the state to actually administer our curriculum outside of that homeschool allotment that we get. And that helps. That provides our teacher, our certified teacher, half of our certified teacher, honestly. It would be helpful for us to receive additional funding to be able to pay our teacher. You know, we can help absorb the cost for other things, but we need to be able to have some recurring funding that allows us to, you know, work on our development and keeping our teachers and retaining them. And it's hard to do when you're grant funded and when you're, you know, when you're not sure of what it's going to look like. Through the IHS compact, we have recurring funding that comes through. We know what to expect. We know how to budget. It's not to say we're getting a huge amount of money. You know, through the IHS compact, I get like something like $80,000 total to run all my health programs, right? That's not a huge amount of money. But then it allows me to budget and fill in gaps as needed. And tribes are really adept and successful at utilizing resources. And that's where I think we are great partners because we fill in voids all over the place. Usually my programs, my health and education programs, are pieced together from numerous funding sources, including my own. You know, every speaking engagement I get that I go out and do and they offer a stipend for goes right to the school. But that's what we do. And so I see this as a hugely successful opportunity of really – you know, if the state and tribes can't come together to support our children, to support our future, you know, the future growth of an educational system that struggles and always has and probably always will if we don't figure out how to collaborate effectively together, you know, this is the one opportunity to do that. You know, we figured out how to do it with the IHS. We figured out how to do it with the BIA and other mechanisms because they recognize that we're good stewards of resources. And so I think it's just building the relationship, building the trust. It took a long time out here in the MACSU to do that. But now they're realizing if they, you know, help us with a little bit of curriculum here, you know, we take on the instruction for these students. We're providing not so much more than just education. We are culturally centered. We're offering a safety net for our kids. Our kids don't fear here. They don't have that fear of what might happen to them. They are safe, and they know it. They're loved. We buy them hairbrushes and combs and toothbrushes so that we can ensure they're cared for. We feed them. We provide food for them. We cook for them. You know, all these things. And these are people that come and help do this, community people. They are wrapped around and loved.
Well, thank you so much.
That's what we can offer.
Thank you so much,
Lisa.
We
need to work on, you know, what gets in the way of that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Senator Hughes has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, and you don't have to commit, but just to throw out the idea of possibly during the interim, when it's in the fall and the students are in session, whether we might be able as a committee to possibly visit. It's because it is very convenient for me, of course. But it's not too far of a drive either from Anchorage, so just would put a request and to kind of see how the community is involved, maybe a chance to watch a classroom in action, speak with the teacher. I just put that request out.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. As Lisa was talking, I was thinking the very same thing, and I'd love to see the school, and we can certainly make those arrangements if we ever get out of here and before school is out. I suspect we will, so we can certainly. And Lisa, would that be something that you'd be willing to allow us to come to your school and see how it's operating?
Of course. We have a saying, "Everyone's welcome." We're all respectful, and everyone's welcome in our house, in our chama.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's a pleasure hearing what you're doing there and how successful your school is, and just how you're culturally addressing the issues and helping your students so much. So thank you very much, Lisa.
Thank you.
I did refer earlier to a document that I wanted to make sure everyone recognizes. It's from Mayor Coet with our legal service, legislative legal services, and she was asked about the came up in our last discussion about the constitutionality of state tribal education compacts, particularly in prioritizing hiring of teachers, but also in prioritizing the admission of students. So I'd recommend that you take a chance, take time to look at that. It's very complex, but we have it available to you if you haven't, if you don't have it. Okay. Yeah, we'll take a brief at ease. It's available. We'll get a copy to everyone, and I think it'd be of value to the department as well to see it. And a complex subject, which attorneys never make it very simple to understand, but brings up all the issues that concerns that we have had about the Constitution of the State of Alaska in regards to this, as well as the United States Constitution. Okay, well, let's move on to our final presenter today, and that's Siri Tuttle, the director of Alaska Native Language Center. Siri Tuttle, are you with us?
Yes, I am with you.
Well, thank you very much. If you'd put your name on the record and tell us who you represent.
Okay. My name is Siri Tuttle. I'm the director of the Alaska Native Language Center, which is located at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and that's where I am today. The Language Center was founded by the Alaska Legislature in 1972. Our mission is to cultivate and promote Alaska's 20 native languages. Our functions include research, language teaching, linguistics teaching, and publication of books in and about Alaska Native languages. We also staff and support the Alaska Native Language Archive. So this is my second year as director, and I've been at UAF since 2003 at ANLC. But I've been working with Alaska Native Languages since 1990 as a linguist. And I was thinking that what I could best do in talking to you this morning is to bring in another angle to the things that Joel and Lisa talked about. From my point of view, because I've worked primarily with the Dene or Athabaskan languages, and many of them are on the road system. So I've been working with communities that have had their languages perhaps most endangered, and places where it may be the most difficult, actually, to create a local school where you have functioning language instruction going on. And so I have met a lot of these people, like Joel and like the founders of the Onondaga School, who are fearless learners of their languages, and have been leading the charge, leading the way to revitalization of language, even though they themselves did not grow up as speakers. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the particular issues that they face as they are developing themselves and developing their projects. These are the people who are learning their indigenous language as a second language, but they have grown up in a majority language. In our case, it's always English. They have to develop language proficiency themselves so that they can transmit language to another generation. Yanadaa School is an example of a place where that whole cycle has actually taken place. So I was really happy to be hearing from Lisa and hearing how wonderfully they're doing at this point. When I used to visit them back a few years, they were teaching their kids in three or four tiny cabins. They didn't even have their one-room schoolhouse yet, and yet they were already doing this. They were already learning and teaching at the same time. What we may not realize about the inclusion of language in this model of local schooling is how much work it takes on the part of these innovators. They have to take on the labor of self-instruction in the language, and that can take years of apprenticeship to elders, as well as studying the language's documentation, what's been studied, what's been archived, and all of that, before the learner can be a teacher. And then they have to create a model for instruction, for language instruction, when perhaps they may never have been instructed in a school in their language. And this model has to work while the teacher is also continuing to learn. Then there's been the daily task of teaching and the everyday accounting of taking care of the institution. And as Yanada'a was developing, there was also, and I kind of think there still is, continued monitoring of funding so that the institution can keep going. So this level of dedication and self-supporting in schooling is something that I've certainly never seen anywhere else. It exists here. It exists in these small communities where there are few to no speakers who grew up speaking their language. And I think that as part of the plan, if state tribal compacting is going to work and to include language, is these people have to have some kind of support to be learners, to be apprentice teachers, and then to be teachers. There needs to be a pathway to professionalization in this particular model. And I'm really excited to see what it's going to be. When Lisa is talking about how they have people coming and visiting and observing their school, that's one side, one piece of this. It's going to be helpful for people to see an institution that's already working this way. But perhaps there's also a way to let people who are working on a school in another place apprentice as participants in building local school building with Yanada'a, because there is so much to it. There's just such a huge amount to it. It's not like everybody's going to be able to follow the same model. Everybody, each place is going to have its own innovation, its own innovators, and its own style, and it's going to bring in very special things because of the people involved. It's always a small group of people. It's always a small group of dedicated and very creative individuals that can bring up something like this to pass. And so it's not going to be a formula, but I think Lisa's right that people need to learn from missions that have been successful and then go out and work on how it can be, how the learning can be applied in their own site. And I would follow up that by saying university currently supports a number of these learners. So we have these language learners in master's programs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We have them in the master's program in applied linguistics sometimes. Sometimes they're just taking classes in language. Sometimes they're working on linguistics in order to understand documentation. And sometimes they're just working with us informally outside of credited classes because we're one of their resources. So university can probably do better developing programs that will support the people who will be part of this development. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that could happen. But the one thing I would add that's so important, and Lisa mentioned it, recurrent funding. Schools are not projects. If this system is developed, there needs to be recurrent funding, and there needs to be a solid base so that nobody feels like they're going to be able to run their school for a year and then would have to give it up. That would be an enormous waste. And we've already seen for many years the waste that's engendered by a project-based economy in research. So recurrent funding, super important. And that's what I would say for now, and I'd be very happy to take questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Siri. I guess I was thinking about in my education, I was forced to get my degree both French and Spanish, which I never used after college. This is so much more meaningful where you're learning the language of your ancestors, your native language, and even though as important as that is, that doesn't get in the way of the student's success should they choose to enter society and get a job and have to speak English, so it doesn't get in the way. I mean, I assume that'd be true. Is that right, Siri?
Absolutely. People have had notions about, retarded development in one language if you're hearing too much of another, but this is the only nation in the world where monolingualism is normal. Bilingualism, multilingualism is normal through most of the planet. And it doesn't hurt people at all. I think it makes us smarter.
Well, I appreciate those comments. And I know I learned more about English by taking French and Spanish than I ever did
in
the English class.
That's true. We don't tend to teach grammar in English anymore. It's out of fashion. But in order to learn a new language, you have to address its grammar. So that makes you more aware of structures, more aware of the interesting facts about your language. Now, I'm going to start talking like a linguist. That's not good.
Okay. Siri, thanks so much. Any questions, comments? Well, thank you very much, Siri. I appreciate your joining us today. And we've had a great opportunity, great learning opportunity here with Joel and Lisa and Siri. And if there's nothing further to come before us, any further comments or closing comments? If not, we are adjourned at 10:11.